carry him. To the agreed number, then, of 70, Israel pulled out of the grove of Mamre the Amorite. Counting everything not counted in, shepherds, drovers, drivers, baggage men, and slaves, the train was all of 100 persons and more, a highly colored, noisy caterpillar of a migrating tribe, slow-moving, enveloped in clouds of dust raised by the trotting flocks. Its members got forward by various means, and between ourselves, the host of Egyptian conveyances sent by Joseph were of very little use. This does not apply to the so-called agolt, whose value should be acknowledged. These were heavy, two-wheeled ox carts, wonderful for household goods, leather water bottles, and forage, as well as for the women and children. But the actual traveling carriages, such as the light merkoped, some of them very luxuriously equipped and drawn by a team of horses or mules, with the shapely wagon box covered with stamped purple leather, open behind and often consisting simply of a curved wooden railing gilded in every possible place, these elegant toys, however well-meaning Joseph and his royal master had been in sending them, proved impracticable, and went back to Egypt mostly as empty as they had come. Nobody had any good of the fact that some of them were covered inside and out with linen and stucco, and in the stucco delightful little reliefs of court and peasant life, or that the nails on the wheels were in the form of Moors' heads, exquisitely modeled. Only 2 persons could stand in these chariots, or 3 if they were crowded. They had no springs and were tiring in the long run over ungentle roads. Or if you sat down, you had to sit backwards on the floor with your legs dangling out. Some, like Tamar, chose the time-honored way of the pilgrim and went on foot with a staff. Most of them, however, rode on splay-footed camels, bony mules, white or gray asses, all of them decorated with big glass beads, embroidered saddle-cloths, and dangling mullein stalks. Those were the saddle animals who stirred up the dust in the roads. On them rode Jacob's people, whom Joseph had sent for, a gay, high-colored tribe, in garments of woven wool, the bearded men in their heavy desert cloaks, with headcloths often held in place by a felt ring on top. The women had black braids hanging on their shoulders, silver and bronze bracelets on their wrists. Their foreheads were hung with coins, their nails reddened with henna. They carried sucklings in their arms, swaddled in great soft wrappings with brocaded borders. They all munched as they rode along, roasted onions, sour bread, and olives. They mostly took the ridge road going down from Jerusalem and the heights of Hebron to the deeper southland called Negeb, the arid land to Kirjath-Sefer, the book city, and to Beersheba. Our chief concern, of course, is the comfort of Jacob the father. How was he accommodated? Had Joseph, when he sent his wagons, thought that the venerable man would make the journey standing in one of those decorated chariots behind a gilt railing? Not he. Not even Pharaoh, his master, thought that. The directions issued by the beautiful child of Aton from his new-smelling palace had said, "Take your father and carry him." The patriarch was to be born as though in triumph. That was the word used. And among the mostly useless vehicles sent by Joseph was a single conveyance of a different kind, destined for precisely this solemn service, the carrying of Jacob. It was an Egyptian litter, such as the upper classes of Keme used on the streets and when they traveled, an exceptionally elegant specimen, too, with a woven reed backrest, the sides adorned with fine writings, with rich hangings and bronze carrying poles. It was even provided with a light, gaily painted wooden hood at the back for protection against dust and wind. This chair could be carried by boys or on the back of animals by means of cross poles. Jacob was very comfortable in it, once he had made up his mind to use it. He did so only from Beersheba on, that being in his mind the boundary line between home and foreign land. Up to that point, he was carried by a dromedary, a wise, slow-gazing beast, on a saddle with a sunshade fastened to it. The old man was a very fine and dignified sight, and he knew it, too, as, surrounded by his sons, he swayed along on his high perch at the rocking gait of his clever beast. The fine wool of his kafia was fringed unevenly across his forehead. It lay in folds about neck and shoulder, and fell softly on the dark red garment open at the front to reveal the embroidered undergarment. The breezes played in his silver beard. The inward gaze of his gentle shepherd eyes showed that he was musing on his tales, both past and future, and nobody ventured to disturb him. At most, they inquired respectfully now and again after his comfort. Foremost in his mind was the expected sight of the sacred tree at Beersheba, planted by Abram, beneath which he meant to sacrifice, to give instruction, and to sleep. Jacob teaches and dreams. The giant tamarisk stood on a hill of medium height near the populated settlement of Beersheba, which our travelers passed by on one side. Beneath its shade stood a primitive stone table and an upright stone column, or masiba. The tree had, strictly speaking, probably not been planted by Jacob's father's father, but taken over by him from the children of the land and changed from a Baal shrine into a tree of God and Elon Morah, or oracle tree, the central point of a shrine and cult of the highest and only God. Jacob might easily know this without being shaken in his belief that the tree was planted by Abram. In a symbolic sense, it was, and the mental processes of the father were broader and gentler than ours, which know only one thing or else the other, and are prone to shout, banging on the table, "If that had been a Baal tree, then Abram did not plant it." Such zeal for the truth is more peppery and thick-headed than wise, and there is far more dignity in the quiet reconciliation of both points of view, as Jacob achieved it. But the forms in which Israel worshipped the eternal God under the tree did not, after all, differ much from the cult of the children of Canaan. Aside from all the offensive sporting and unseemliness in which the worship of those children used inevitably to wind up, at the foot of the sacred hill, round about, the rest tents were set up, and preparations for the slaughtering got under way at once, to be performed on the dolmen, the primitive stone table, and afterwards partaken of in common, the sacrificial meal. Had the children of Baal done otherwise? Had not they too let the blood of sheep and goats run down upon the altar, and struck the caked side posts with the blood? Surely they had. But the children of Israel did it in a different spirit, and in a more enlightened wise, as is clear from the fact that after the sacred meal they did not sport with each other in pairs, at least not publicly. And Jacob instructed them in God, too, under the tree, and it did not bore them. Even the young found his words most interesting and important, because they were all more or less gifted in that way, and eagerly seized even on the subtleties of his remarks. He showed them the difference between the many-namedness of Baal and that of their father, the highest and only. The many-named Baal was a true plurality. There was no one Baal, but many, the occupants, possessors, and patrons of cult sites, groves, shrines, springs, trees. A host of gods of dwelling and soil, who worked singly and locally, had in their collectivity no face, no person, no proper name, and at most were called Melkart, city king, if they were that sort of deity. As, for instance, him of Tyre. One was called Baal Peor, after his site, or Baal Hermon, or Baal Meon. One was Baal of the Bond, of course, which had been useful in Abram's work on God. There was even one called, quite absurdly, Dance Baal. There was not much dignity about this, and very little collective majesty. Quite otherwise was it with the many names of God the Father, which did no violence whatsoever to his personal oneness. He was called El Elyon, the Highest, El Roi, the God that sees one, El Olam, God of the Aeons, or, after Jacob's great vision sprung from his humiliation, El Bethel, the God of Luz. But all these were only interchangeable designations for one and the same highest existing personal God. Not localized, existing in everything, like the labeled multiplicity of the Baal gods of town and country, the single proprietorship of which was ascribed to them, the fertility they bestowed, the springs they guarded, the trees wherein they dwelt and murmured, the tempest they raged in, the burgeoning spring, the parching east wind. He was all this that they singly were. To him it all belonged. He was the all-God of all of it, for from him it came. In himself he comprehended it, saying, I, the being of all being, Elohim, the many as one. On the subject of this name, Jacob exhausted himself. He spoke most engrossingly for his audience, and not without subtlety. It was clear whence Dan, his fifth son, got his type of mind, though it was only a poor second-generation derivative from his father's much higher qualities. The question Jacob discussed was whether one was to regard Elohim as singular or plural, to say, Elohim wills it, or the Elohim will it. If you admitted the importance of correct syntax, you must make the distinction, and Jacob seemed to make it correctly in deciding for the singular. God was one, and he who thought that Elohim was the plural of El, or God, involved himself in grave error. The plural of God would be Elim. Elohim was something quite different. It did not mean a multiplicity any more than the name Abram. The man from Ur had been named Abram, and then had the honor of having his name expanded into Abraham. The same was true of Elohim. It was an honorific expansion, nothing else. Certainly it had no taint of what one condemned as polytheism. The teacher stressed the point. Elohim was one. But then again it transpired that there were several of him, some three. Three men came to Abraham in the grove of Mamre as he sat at the door of his house in the heat of the day. And the three men were, as the hasting Abraham soon saw, God the Lord. Lord, he had said, bowing to the earth, Lord and Thou. But also now and then, Lords and You. He had prayed them to sit down in the shade and strengthen themselves with milk and the flesh of cows. And they ate. And then they said, I will come to you in a year. That was God. He was one, but he was explicitly threefold. He practiced manifoldness, but always and on principle said, I, whereas Abraham had addressed him by turns in the singular and the plural. The use of the name Elohim as a plural, his audience heard Jacob further say, had, despite all the above stress to the contrary, something in its favor after all. Yes, as they heard him go on, they got a glimmer of an idea that his experience of God, like Abram's, had been threefold, and comprised three men, three independent, and yet again coincident persons. He spoke, that is, first of all, of the Father God, or God the Father. Second, of a good shepherd who fed his flocks, and third, of one whom he called the angel, of whom the 70 got the impression that he overshadowed as with the wings of doves. Altogether, they were Elohim, the threefold unity. I cannot tell whether all that goes home to you, but for Jacob's hearers under the tree, it was vastly interesting and exciting. They had taste and gifts for such things. As they dispersed, and afterwards in their tents before they slept, they discussed what they had heard, long and eagerly. The honorific expansion, and Abram's threefold guest, the avoidance of polytheism enjoined upon them in view of a God out of whose manifold existence there yet went a certain temptation in that direction, all that being like a test of their capacity for God-thoughts, a test to which all of Jacob's people, even the youngest, felt blithely adequate. Their head and chief had his place spread under the sacred tree all the three nights he spent at Beersheba. The first two nights he did not dream, but the third brought him the vision to receive which he slept, and which he needed for consolement and strength. He was afraid of Egypt. He urgently needed the assurance that he need not fear to go down thither, since the God of his fathers was not a local deity, and would be with him in the lower world, as he had been with him in Laban's land. He had need to his heart's depths of the confirmation that God did not only go down with him, but after he had made them a multitude, would lead him, or at least his seed, back into the land of his fathers. That was the land between Nimrod's kingdoms, an ignorant land indeed, and full of foolish aborigines, but yet no Nimrod kingdom. There, better than anywhere else, one might serve a spiritual God. In short, what he so thirsted for was the assurance that the promise of the great dream of the ladder that had come to him in Gilgal of Bethel should not be cancelled by his going hence, but that God the King stood by his word which he had sung to the sound of harps. It was to hear this that he slept, and in sleep he heard it. God spoke to him in a solemn voice, and promised that of which his soul had need. But sweetest of all was the promise that Joseph should put his hands upon thine eyes, a profound and meaningful expression which might signify that the all-powerful Son would protect him and care for his old age among the heathen, but also that his darling would one day close his eyes, a dream in which for so long now Jacob had not let himself indulge. Now he let himself dream both this and the other, and his sleeping eyes were wet beneath their lids. But when he woke, he was strengthened and reassured, and anxious to proceed onwards with all the 70. He mounted the fine Egyptian carrying chair, which was slung across the backs of 2 white asses adorned with mullein stalks. In it, he looked even finer and more stately than on the camel.